Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. You could walk into the lobby of the downtown Salt Lake City office building that houses the Intermountain West RCFL without ever realizing what goes on three floors above. Step onto the elevator and ride it up to the third floor, though, and you will come to a locked door at Suite 300.
Third floor.
A piece of laminated paper taped to the door tells you to push a button to the right and wait for a response. Be patient, it says. It may take some time to get an answer. Getting into the RCFL requires going through a series of key-coded doors and a metal detector. The people who work there are not your typical office staff. They're federal law enforcement.
So we're essentially a digital forensic task force. The FBI in the early to mid-90s started seeing the need for doing digital forensics because obviously computers, phones were starting to become more prevalent. And so they started training agents to become these digital forensic examiners.
That's Chaney Eng Tao, FBI Supervisory Special Agent and head of the Intermountain West RCFL. He says there are currently 16 other RCFLs like this one spread out across the country. The FBI pays for them and staffs them, but the agents assigned to these regional computer forensic laboratories don't just work on federal cases. They also help with investigations from state-level agencies and even small-town police departments.
So any law enforcement agency can bring us items. They just come here, they submit it to us. We have a group of certified forensic examiners who are certified by the FBI. They go through extensive training. It takes about 2 years to become a certified examiner.
Pretty much all of the digital data seized by police during the Susan Powell investigation ended up here at some point in this unassuming third floor office suite.
When you have a case of the, you know, the magnitude of the Powell case, they really needed to look at every single document, right? And it's just time-consuming.
Some of those documents remain locked away from view, behind a wall of encryption, even to this day. Still, clues uncovered here at the RCFL did help steer the investigation in some unexpected directions. This is Cold, Episode 12, Topaz Mountain. I'm Dave Cawley. Back after this.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system. The home of Mario and Friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder. Or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
During the first 10 days of the search for Susan, West Valley detectives served three search warrants at Josh and Susan's home on Sarah Circle. They also served a warrant on his minivan. Each time, they came away with digital devices. By my count, that included at least 7 computers, 7 hard drives, 5 flash drives, 3 SD cards, 2 cell phones, a digital camera, and a camcorder. Here's how the RCFL handled all that kind of stuff. An investigator brought in a piece of evidence, a computer, cell phone, flash drive, or whatever. The RCFL then paired up that outside investigator with one of its FBI-trained examiners.
We work with the case agent because it's their case. They bring it to us. We're assisting them, but we don't know the full background of the case.
With a computer hard drive or flash drive, they made a bit-for-bit copy called a mirror. Then they used a hash. That's an algorithm that provides something akin to a unique fingerprint for a device or file to make sure the mirror exactly matched the original.
And we just work off of that image. We never touch the original item, which is different than, you know, if you have blood evidence, you to do DNA on blood, you have to take some of that sample in order to get the DNA results. We don't have to do that with digital evidence. We can make a verified copy, so to speak.
At the time, RCFLs were using a number of different software utilities to extract information from the mirrors. In the Powell case, that usually meant a program called Forensic Toolkit, produced by the company Access Data. FTK, as it's also known, examined every sector of the mirror, even the blank space.
You know, when you delete a file, say in Windows, you're not really deleting the file. You're just telling the computer that that space that it took on the hard drive is now available to use again. So until that information is written over, those files could be retrieved.
And even when parts of the file were overwritten, these forensic software programs could sometimes reconstruct the rest by finding the remaining segments.
Typically, when you save a file, it's not saving it to just one sector on the hard drive. It could save it in like 20 pieces. So sometimes you could have several pieces overwritten, but the majority of the other pieces remain. So you might still be able to retrieve the majority of the file.
In the end, FTK generated a report with hyperlinks, like the links you would find on a website, that pointed to specific files. That way, the investigators could sift out anything that was not relevant to their case.
And it'll actually break it out into types, you know, like it could be JPEGs, Word documents, emails. You then can go through and review the files on there.
As you might imagine, this work required a lot of time.
You can search terms with our software, but in the end, that's just going to find those terms. I mean, there may be stuff in the document that, unless you actually look at the document, you're not going to know whether it was really relevant or not. It takes that human element.
The investigators had to locate the signal amidst the noise. The more noise and the quieter the signal, the harder that job became. West Valley's records show it took months to review the computers and devices seized during those first 10 days. The most important stuff from an evidence point of view turned out to be two of Josh's computers, an HP laptop and a Dell desktop. As you heard in the last episode, the internet search history on the laptop was very telling. The RCFL found pictures that appeared to have been taken inside a mine or cave. There were images of spelunkers and news photos of a deadly caving accident that had happened at a place in Utah called Nutty Putty Cave just a couple of weeks before Susan disappeared. Sheriff's deputies had sealed the opening of that cave, leaving the body of a deceased man entombed inside. The forensic software uncovered pornography on the laptop as well. It appeared to be relatively simple striptease stuff, downloaded from commercial websites. Nothing illegal. The images were tucked away in a temporary folder under Josh's user account. Not a likely place for anyone to look. It's not like Susan could have looked anyway. Here's what she wrote in 2009 about the family's February trip to Washington.
With Josh's dad, we drove to Port Angeles one day. Anything involving Josh and or his dad were well documented via digital video and photos. I've never really had access to all of our digital memorabilia.
Josh's desktop computer was another story. The pornography found there was of an altogether different type. The RCFL found cartoon images showing characters from The Simpsons, Pokemon, The Last Airbender, and other animated shows engaging in sexual acts. There were internet search strings related to incest and stories involving the rape of Harry Potter characters. They discovered all of this relatively early on in the investigation. Ellis Maxwell told me West Valley tried to develop criminal charges against Josh on two of those images, which were morphed pictures of teen celebrities Emma Watson and Miley Cyrus.
You know, they're like, oh, yeah, we can do that. And we presented it to them, and then they're like, oh, no. And it's like, okay, so you just basically wanted to see what we had. and it was really frustrating.
Ellis didn't want to tell me which prosecutors were involved, but files I've obtained show West Valley and the FBI presented their case to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They declined to file charges because there was no way to definitively say who had downloaded or created those pictures. The RCFL also found internet search strings about erectile dysfunction during heterosexual intercourse. One of the external hard drives contained male-on-male pornography. The web history on Josh's laptop included visits to news stories about the conviction of Amanda Knox. She'd been accused of killing her roommate, Meredith Kircher, in Italy 2 years earlier. An Italian jury had convicted her on December 5th, 2 days before Susan's disappearance. Josh Powell understood the vulnerabilities presented by his digital devices. As noted in prior episodes, he had removed the SIM cards from both his and Susan's cell phones before West Valley Police could take them.
SIM cards these days don't really contain a whole lot of data. In the old days, they used to, but not anymore.
At the RCFL, investigators also discovered that Josh had used a program called Eraser. It could securely delete files and not leave behind traces that forensic software like FTK was designed to find. Even worse, they realized Josh had been using a program called TrueCrypt to encrypt some of his files and devices. One of the external hard drives seized from his basement office on December 17th of 2009 was completely inaccessible due to encryption.
Really, what it comes down to is how long or sophisticated the password is. Because to break encryption, typically you're just doing so-called like brute force. You're just trying combinations from dictionary, combinations of letters, alphanumeric characters. And so the longer that password is, the longer it's going to be before you can break it.
Josh did not use a weak password, at least not on that encrypted Western Digital hard drive taken from his basement. RCFL attempted to crack it without any luck. West Valley Police asked the makers of the FTK toolkit software to take a stab at it as well. They even sent a mirror of that encrypted drive to the Secret Service, experts in cryptography, in June of 2010, but they fared no better than the RCFL. By May of 2011, West Valley Police had determined the encryption could not be cracked. They then turned to a private vendor, a Utah company called Decipher Forensics, and asked for their help. As of October of 2017, Decipher had not been able to get past the encryption. Cluster computing, where a series of computers are linked together and set at a single task, can speed up the process of brute forcing a password. RCFLs use that technique sometimes. But even that doesn't always do the job.
We've also had ones where we've been using our cluster to try and break these encryption and run it for months, and it's tried billions and billions of combinations and never broke it.
The search warrant that had authorized the raid of Steve Powell's home on August 25th of 2011 made specific note of the ongoing problem posed by Josh's use of encryption. It said more than a terabyte of Josh's data remained locked. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's 1 terabyte of unseen evidence in the Powell case.
But who knows, is there something on there that is incriminating or not? You'll never know until you actually get into it and see it.
And of course, people encrypt files for any number of legitimate reasons, protecting bank records, personal data, or private messages. Still, many people believe cracking Josh's encryption holds the last best hope for finding Susan.
It's good maybe to be optimistic like that, but in the end, there could be nothing on it of value.
On the same September day that Pierce County deputies seized Josh's backup hard drive from his safe deposit box, a judge in Utah signed a warrant that gave West Valley Police permission to start tearing into the mountain of digital data they'd taken out of Steve Powell's home during that search warrant raid on August 25th. In a decidedly analog twist, the detectives also took every single sticky note and scrap of paper they found in the house that might hold a password. They looked for strings of letters and numbers, or even names, kids' names, pets' names, birth dates, the things people often use as password material. And there's a good reason for that. Strong, complex passwords are difficult to remember.
So what do people do? They have to write it down somewhere. You know, maybe they use some kind of password keeping program. Maybe they just put it in a little notes in their phone, whatever it happens to be. You know, some people still put it on a sticky note, put it under their keyboard, right?
The detectives realized none of the computers they'd found were from Steve's work. So they went back several days later to seize his work-issued laptop. It, like the backup hard drive Josh had tucked away in a safe deposit box, ended up at the RCFL. The forensic review of the computers and devices seized in Washington began in mid-September of 2011. It didn't finish until the following summer. That timeline speaks to the huge task of sifting through thousands upon thousands of files. Computer security experts have told me one way criminals try to hide their tracks is by creating a large number of irrelevant files.
It could be either they've created all this digital evidence, or it's just that they have, you know, like 20 computers in their house and they just have so many items. You know, when you have that, it makes it much more difficult because it's much more time consuming to go. While the software does a lot of the processing and stuff, it still takes that human element to go through the things and determine what's relevant and what's not.
Josh was a digital pack rat. He'd kept scanned copies of almost every piece of paperwork in his life. You might remember he even made scanning his receipts one of Susan's household chores. Here's what Josh told his sister Jennifer about scanning in a February 1999 email.
I plan to make many copies of my data and spread them around with family and friends. A lot of stuff will be encrypted for privacy, but I may leave other things usable. That way people don't feel like it's just a chore to save my CDs.
The files on his computers included letters he'd written to and received from friends all the way back to his teenage years. There were scanned copies of birthday, Christmas, and Valentine's Day cards, wedding announcements, programs from weekly church meetings, high school essays, job applications, and resumes, long outdated lists of phone numbers, none of these having to do with Susan's disappearance.
I am scanning everything right now. Once I am on top of it, it will be easy to keep up to date. I find things easily now, and when I need to move, I don't have to lug so much paperwork. It makes a nice journal, too. Maybe my descendants, or myself, will want to see what my bank statements looked like back in 1996. A lifetime of files could possibly fit on a few CDs if you do it right.
While conducting research for this podcast, I requested police turn over a small selection of files the RCFL recovered from Josh's devices. Their notes indicated the files included text and audio journals produced by Josh. I wanted to know what those journals said. West Valley Police provided me with a DVD that held more than 3,500 files. Many were duplicates and irrelevant to what I wanted to learn, but finding that out meant personally reviewing and cataloging each file. You've already heard the fruit of much of that work in earlier episodes, like Josh's old audio journals.
Then I got here, and Susan was sitting on the couch, which is kind of unusual. She usually meets me at the door. She had a blanket on her. Turns out she just waxed her legs. She was waiting for me to get home so she could show me. Discreetly, of course. We cuddled a little bit, and then I ate. I just had chips with salsa and English muffin. After a little while longer of just being together, Susan did a little cleaning. I brushed my teeth.
What you didn't hear were the pointless recordings Josh made of his own voicemails.
Thursday, March 29th, 2001. These are messages from my home phone over the past couple days.
Monday, 9:29 p.m. Josh, there's a payroll check here for you. Thursday, 1 a.m.
I love you.
Thursday, 1:03 a.m.
I love you, honey. Why aren't you answering? Hi.
That's just a small piece of what the detectives had to review. Although it took months, new leads did arise out of that work. They found Steve Powell's digital journal, where he referenced Josh and Michael talking about a place called Rattlesnake Rock. I mentioned that back in episode 7. Detectives immediately went to work, poring over maps and looking for any place with Rattlesnake in the name. At the start of October, they went out to examine mine shafts on the fringe of the West Desert, near a place called Rattlesnake Pass. But just like with every other search, they came back empty-handed. A little less than a month after the launch of Operation Tsunami, and shortly before that search around Rattlesnake Pass, West Valley Police kicked off their biggest desert search of all, at Topaz Mountain.
It was a reference, I believe, that we found in his writings, referencing that area.
And of course, police had Susan's pictures from the family's May 2009 overnighter on the Pony Express Trail, and Charlie's comments from December 8th of 2009 about his mom staying with the pretty crystals, a possible reference to the Dugway geode beds or Topaz Mountain.
My mom stayed where a crystal are.
Where what are?
Where crystals are.
The crystals? Yeah. Crystals?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Crystals?
Yeah.
Your mom stayed where the crystals are?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mentioned this interview with Charlie in episode 7. At the time, I didn't have access to it. That's obviously changed.
So why did Mommy stay?
Because there was flowers and crystals that was colorful.
That was what?
That was colorful.
Colorful?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Police had scoured the area multiple times before, but on September 12th, 2011, they came back in full force with aircraft, ATVs, and horseback riders.
They're also utilizing the assistance of some specialized dogs from the Carbon County Sheriff's Office. And those are dogs that are specialized in searching for people.
The searchers quickly cleared the geode beds and moved down the eastern side of the Thomas Range. Lieutenant Bill Merritt met with reporters near Topaz Mountain.
Just doing a general search of this particular area. We are just following up on a couple things on our task list that need to be done and need to be completed. And we're at that point where we can actually get to it now. And we want to make sure we take care of it before the weather turns bad.
There was one other, better reason he didn't mention. Information overheard on the wiretap. The original plan was to wrap up the operation by September 15th, right as the wiretap from Operation Tsunami was expiring.
There's a possibility that we might find something out here. Now, we're not coming out here with an absolute saying that we will, but we're just hoping. We're fairly confident that there may be something of value out here. We don't know for sure. We may leave empty-handed.
But on September 14th, the dogs caught a scent near a road on the eastern flank of Topaz Mountain. Several of them all gave the same indication at the same spot, a pile of rocks. It appeared to possibly be a gravesite.
We have confirmed with several of the dogs who have indicated positively several times that it is human remains.
Back in West Valley, detectives scrambled to get a 30-day extension for the wiretap from a judge. Meantime, at Topaz Mountain, they started to dig. The work crept along, with detectives shoveling dirt into buckets. Forensic specialists sifted each bucket of dirt through a mesh screen, looking for any bone fragments or tissue. Each night, an officer kept a solitary vigil over the site, beneath a clear desert sky filled with stars. Chuck Cox bought a one-way plane ticket from Seattle to Salt Lake City, then drove the bumpy dirt road out to the site.
Yeah, I'd like to know they found something. I haven't heard that yet, so they haven't called me or anything. So.
It didn't take long for police to hedge their bets. They soon downgraded their assessment to 50-50 that they had found Susan's gravesite. The dogs, though, continued to indicate on the growing pit.
They are still indicating on human decomposition, but there has been nothing that has been found thus far.
A reporter in Washington confronted Josh with word that police had found human remains at Topaz Mountain. He offered a simple no comment. On the wiretap, he again seemed unconcerned. Police allowed Chuck Cox to see their work firsthand.
I was able to see where they're excavating and that the work's going on. They explained to me how they're processing the scene, and it's very logical, and it's what needs to be done, so I have every confidence in what they're doing.
Mid-September stretched on into late September.
I don't know how long it'll take, and I just feel that, you know, this is a worthwhile investigation and a good place to be looking, and I need to stay till we find out, you know, what we have found here.
Finally, the excavation unearthed a number of small pieces of charred wood. No body, No bones. Police removed those cinders, and when they did, the dogs lost interest. Detectives supposed someone might have burned bloody clothing or evidence on that wood. They sent the fragments in for forensic testing, but those tests came back negative. There was no DNA.
Yeah, we come across something that we think is going to be beneficial for the case. It's our big break. And at the end of the day, it ends up being nothing. Just another swift kick in the gut.
A kick in the gut, not just for police, but for Susan's family. To this day, Chuck Cox wonders what to make of it.
Like, I think that Pitt had something to do with Susan, but I don't know what. If anything, you know, maybe it's just me imagining it.
While at Topaz Mountain, Chuck spotted a small rock among the excavated debris. It looked different than the others, so he picked it up.
Maybe she was there at one time, or they had been there at one time, or something, I don't know. So I brought it back.
Chuck still has that stone today. It sits on a small shelf in his home.
When I flew home with this in my suitcase, I just felt like this is one time I've come down here and I'm taking home something that might have something to do with Susan versus just, yeah, we didn't find her, go back home, so.
Back to the aftermath of the Washington warrant. The West Valley team also had to review Steve Powell's VHS and Hi-8 videotape collection. Detectives had to sit and watch every single minute a video.
My peers that had to view the material, read the material, bless their hearts, because you know, he was a filthy man.
The tapes ran the gamut, from boring home movie footage of family get-togethers and vacations.
Yeah, but I'll let you here. Let me just get a picture of you two. But let me get it in the sun.
Well, someone just felt the need to decorate their yard.
Two voyeur video clips where Steve filmed women and girls in public without their knowledge.
He loved videotaping women. He'd go to the mall and just videotape them and then loop them. And he loved videotaping himself masturbate and what he masturbated to.
Pierce County Sheriff's Detective Sergeant Gary Sanders spent 8 years working special assault, which included child abuse and sex crimes. He told me Steve Powell's fetishes were among the most bizarre he had ever observed. And of course, no one figured more prominently in Steve's fantasies than Susan.
Anyway, I just wanted to get you in that dress. That's so.
Yep. And they always want our hair up. Uh-huh. So at dinner time.
And the videos that he did, he would, you know, take videos of her and play them on one screen and then masturbate and videotape himself masturbating to that. So, I mean, just stuff normal people don't do. And he'd loop a lot. He did a lot of looping where he'd play it over and over again just for his own pleasure and stuff. So he had some fetishes, some crazy, weird fetishes.
The detectives who did this work endured a lot. They also found something completely unexpected. Images of two prepubescent children, girls, who'd been filmed while naked or partially clothed. The images were screen grabs from videos that had been saved onto a CD. They were contained in a folder titled Neighbors, which held subfolders with titles like Taking Bath 1, Taking Bath 2, and Open Window in Back House. They'd been captured on various days and times, as the detectives could see, based on changes in lighting and what the girls were wearing. Detectives guessed their ages at somewhere between 7 and 12. They would later come to learn that the girls had actually been 8 and 10 at the time of the filming. It soon became clear that Steve had shot the video with his camcorder from his bedroom on the second floor of his house, looking through the open bathroom window of the house next door.
Luckily, he never, or at least we don't know of any times where he actually followed through on some of his desires with young girls and stuff like that.
West Valley detectives cataloged every video that appeared to hold evidence of voyeurism or child porn, setting them aside to later provide to Pierce County. The West Valley team also started to review Susan's journals, the ones Josh and Steve had planned to post online. The RCFL flagged hundreds of scanned pages, along with annotations and spreadsheet indexes that Josh and his dad had created. There were drafts for future posts to Josh's SusanPowell.org website.
They basically were trying to, like, just malign her.
Chuck and Judy Cox had retained high-profile Seattle attorney Ann Bremner and filed a civil lawsuit against Josh, Steve, Michael, and Alina the day after the search warrant raid. The cause of action was invasion of privacy.
You know, as a prosecutor, you would use that as evidence of guilt, right? You know, concocting these stories and maligning the victim. I mean, what person in their right mind maligns their wife, you know, who's missing, except for Josh Powell?
The Pierce County Superior Court blocked any further publication of Susan's journals while the case was ongoing.
We got a restraining order against them, too, on the journals. We went and got a TRO.
Josh struck back. In a September 21st, 2011 court declaration, he wrote, "Susan was emotionally fragile because of a troubled childhood," and said publishing her journals was the best way to understand her state of mind.
By denying this reality, I believe the Coxes are actually hindering a legitimate search effort and harming Susan's emotional state, since being misunderstood and manipulated by her parents are at the core of her emotional issues.
As Josh fought in court over Susan's journals, West Valley police were reading Steve's journals. In the very earliest entry, he wrote not about Susan, but instead a woman named Lydia. Steve had briefly interacted with Lydia at a work conference and daydreamed about what his life would be like if they were to marry. If Lydia's name sounds familiar, it's probably because Steve wrote songs about her. Then there was a huge gap. Time in the journals jumped forward to January of 2003, where Susan made her first appearance.
In many ways, my life has seemed out of control. My biggest problem, as well as my greatest pleasure, lies in the fact that for over a year, I have been madly in love with my daughter-in-law, Susan.
Most of the rest of the more than 2,000 pages contained in those journals dealt with Susan in one way or another. He wrote openly about many of the disturbing behaviors we've already talked about.
I imagine my obsession with her, my accumulation of her pictures and underwear, will seem nasty or perverted to some future reader, perhaps a descendant of mine and Susan's. But I am not inclined to hide the depth and power of the desire I feel for her.
He went so far as to describe in detail how he had stalked Susan.
Susan got off work at 9, and I was waiting, concealed near her car. When she was about 100 yards away, I started filming and got her walking all that way with close-ups of her legs, etc. I was kind of making a pretense of hiding, but I knew she knew I was stalking her, and I knew she liked it.
Steve expressed agony when Susan moved away to Utah. He showed anger that she could lead him on and then just abandon him. Always in his mind, it seemed Susan was the instigator. She, he felt, was responsible for his thoughts and actions. Steve often reflected in his journals about the poor state of Josh and Susan's relationship.
Theirs is truly a marriage made in hell. It's hard to believe that two people could be so nasty to each other before they have even celebrated their third anniversary. In public, they look like the loveliest couple, but in private, they have no respect for each other and little love.
Steve rooted for an all-out collapse and divorce, on the assumption it would open up a path for he and Susan to live together.
At best, Josh is indifferent about her. At worst, he dislikes her intensely, but tolerates her because she is a good piece of ass and she keeps money coming in.
I've read all of these journal entries, and a reader comes away from them with the impression that Steve didn't much care for Josh. Privately, Steve mocked his son's inability to hold a job and complained about the way Josh took advantage of people, including his own siblings, to achieve his financial ends. Steve also recognized, at least in some form, that his thoughts and feelings were abnormal. He even said they were akin to alcoholism.
I feel like I'm letting my entire life slide. My bills, my job, my personal life. I'm not responding to customers in a timely way. I'm getting phone calls about bills I've not paid. I have not done my taxes for 2 years.
Steve's pursuit of Susan had derailed every ambition in his life, with the exception of his music. He had spent thousands of dollars on a keyboard and recording console in the belief that his songs held the power to win Susan's heart. He fancied himself quite the maestro.
The sun didn't shine in Seattle this morning. What did you expect? Hey, what's new? What's new?
I think my Light of Seattle has a good chance of being in the common repertory, along with New York, New York, and Chicago Is My Kind of Town, as the song about Seattle.
The light of Seattle is you.
The entries grew increasingly bizarre as detectives continued to read. Steve spelled out his belief that he and Susan shared a psychic link. In his mind, this meant they became aroused at the same time, regardless of where the other person was. His body, he explained, could be poisoned by a buildup of testosterone if he didn't act out his sexual fantasies. Some of the most deeply disturbing journal entries, though, dealt not with Susan, but with Steve's oldest child, Jennifer. He made veiled references to an experience he'd had with Jennifer when she was a young girl. He wondered if Susan gave her own father similar thrills. In her book, A Light in Dark Places, Jennifer shared a story about Steve exposing her to pornography when she was still a child. He had taken Jennifer on a road trip and punched up the video while they were alone together in a motel room. Jennifer told me her co-writer, Emily Clausen, had helped her work through those traumatic memories.
And just face those situations that I had in childhood, honestly, that I had not, I just walked away from. I tried to just block them out. But honestly, if you're just trying to block them out, they're still there. You gotta go through it and work through it and face it eventually. And that was one of the things that was so good about writing the book, was for me personally to be able to go through that and face those things. And it was very therapeutic.
As Josh and Susan's marriage bottomed out in 2008, Steve cheered on the failure.
It is painful to me to be so in love with her and to want her so badly while she says she is committed to a marriage to someone who despises her. I am also vain enough to think that she stays with Josh partly because she is in love with me.
Yet his writings show he also worried about what Josh might do.
Josh hates her so much, he even wishes she were dead. He even talks about it, occasionally fantasizing that she might have an accident. That worries me too, since couples who die in murder-suicide are not that rare.
After Susan's disappearance at the end of 2009, Steve's journal entries shifted to focus on his theory that she absconded, his word, with a secret lover. His tone became angry, especially during rants against the media, the church, and the Cox family.
Chuck Cox comes across as a violent man in Susan's journals. He may have seemed calm, but that is the psychotic calm act all Mormons put on.
That last bit came from an entry on August 4th of 2011, just 3 weeks before police raided Steve's home and seized the journals.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Steve Powell told reporters much of what police had taken from his house could be considered inappropriate and embarrassing. Steve told the news crews he wished that he'd moved those embarrassing things out of the house so they wouldn't have been taken. But he didn't say he was sorry for creating them. Ellis Maxwell hand-delivered Steve's voyeur videos to Gary Sanders in Tacoma on September 18th.
You know, we delivered all that evidence up there. I did it in person with some of my peers and supervisors, sat with the attorneys, went over everything and the detectives up there.
In all, West Valley handed over 7 VHS tapes, 14 Hi-8 cassettes, and 5 CDs to Pierce County. West Valley's team had identified more than 1,600 individual images of those young neighbor girls.
Luckily, they were really good to us, and they kind of categorized what they thought was important. And once we started looking through it, that's where we started developing probable cause for Stephen's arrest on the, you know, photographing the neighbors and then creating the child pornography.
Metadata on the files showed they'd been created with a Sony Handycam camcorder, model number DCR-TRV-460. That's the same model as the camcorder detectives had found in Steve's bedroom the day of the search warrant raid. The metadata also revealed dates. At least some of the images had been created on April 8th of 2007. The investigators figured out who had been living in the house next door at the time. Detective Gary Sanders made contact with the mother of the girls. She'd been Steve's neighbor between June of 2006 and August of 2007. Gary showed the woman some of the images. She confirmed the girls in the pictures were her daughters. Gary explained how he had come into possession of the pictures. Then the mother of the girls started to cry. She was shocked, never having thought that anyone could have been peeping on her daughters through the second floor bathroom window. On September 22nd of 2011, Pierce County prosecutors filed criminal charges of felony voyeurism and possession of depictions of a minor engaged in sexually explicit conduct. Gary knew Steve was not at home, so he went to the neighborhood and waited.
Had somebody sitting on surveillance near the house, saw him come home, so as he comes home, we swoop in. You know, kind of arrive at the same time as he's getting out of his vehicle, and I just walked up to him and said, "Hey, Stephen," and he knew who I was and recognized me. And I said, "You're under arrest for the child pornography and the voyeurism." Put him in handcuffs.
Two of Steve's kids, John and Alina, came out of the house to see what was happening. Ellis, who was also there, told them not only were they there to arrest Steve, they were also taking Charlie and Braden.
The state of Washington made a decision that they were going to take the kids into protective custody because they were living in Steve's home.
The investigators at that point weren't sure if Josh might have helped his dad make the still frame images of the neighbor girls. They also knew that Josh's brother John had at least once greeted police at the door while wearing a diaper, and he was rumored to walk around the house naked. It was not a place for young kids. It was late, around 9:30 at night, and both boys were in their pajamas. They saw Detective Teresa Berg, who they'd interacted with multiple times in the past.
The boys ran to her, and she's like, hey, you want to go? And they're like, yep, let's go.
The police grabbed shoes for the boys, then Teresa took them over to a social worker, who noted both Charlie and Braden seemed bright, energetic, and unconcerned. The social worker drove them away, taking care not to be followed for a secret rendezvous with a foster family. As far as the boys knew, they were just heading off for a sleepover.
That's what was nice for me, is to see them being taken away. But then I felt bad for them too, because they don't understand, and they're young and they're confused and they don't understand what's going on.
But where was Josh?
Josh wouldn't come out. Man, you know, if something like that's going on, you got police outside, your dad's getting arrested, people are taking your kids and stuff like that, you'd think he'd come out. But, and he knew we were there. And so finally I told John, John, go get your brother, tell him to get out here. And so he went inside, got into the house, and Josh came walking out and was like, what's going on? And I'm 100% or 99.99999% sure that he thought he was getting arrested that night too for the murder.
Gary told Josh he wasn't there to arrest him, only Steve, but that Child Protective Services was taking the boys.
The weird thing was he never put up a fight, never asked to hug the kids, kiss the kids, you know, stuff like that. And it goes back to that whole non-emotional, non-loving relationship. You know, you come to my house, try to take my kids, there's going to be a fight. And he was just, oh, okay. And we drove off, you know.
Deputies took Steve to Pierce County's South Hill precinct for questioning.
Read Miranda and sat him down in an interview room, and he played the I'm too stupid to understand what Miranda is and I don't know if I need an attorney, and he just played games.
Gary already had a pretty good idea of how Steve had made the images of the young neighbor girls, but asked him to explain it.
We afforded him an opportunity to tell us side of the story and explain to us why all those things were in there, but he didn't want to do that.
Ellis was there too, and took the opportunity to press Steve for information about Susan. He wanted to know about conversations Steve and Josh had had in the wake of her disappearance.
Even at that time, I didn't feel that, you know, Steve was involved. And obviously my primary focus is Josh and, you know, trying to locate some sort of evidence to give us direction as to where Susan was.
But Steve, who for years had been unable to stop thinking, writing, or singing about Susan, refused to say a word. Looking back now, the night of Steve Powell's arrest seemed like a perfect opportunity for West Valley City Police to have also arrested Josh. As you heard Gary Sanders describe, it seemed as though Josh even expected it. So why didn't they? Ellis told me they were very close, but there were still too many loose ends.
We're coming to the end, and, you know, we're not at a point where we could screen charges quite yet, because if they were to file them, there was still quite a bit of work to do, so that in the event that, you know, I'm up on the stand and the defense attorney's like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? I want to be able to answer.
Removing the kids had taken them out of harm's way and also put fresh pressure on Josh.
It left Josh kind of in a vulnerable state, and it allowed us to kind of, press him a little bit more to see you know, if he would disclose anything or revisit where he disposed Susan.
As the Pierce County Sheriff's chief liaison on the Powell investigation, Gary Sanders had almost as much information about the case as anyone outside of the West Valley City Major Crimes Unit.
There was only one suspect. Just the evidence, his story, his, you know, and just totality of circumstances led the spotlight right on one guy.
Gary told me, though, the decision of whether or not to arrest Josh that night was not his to make.
We respected that. You know, I understand, you know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback, but you had to think about, you know, their thought process and their prosecutor if they didn't want to do a no-body prosecution. But sometimes you just got to pull the trigger and do it.
Susan's dad, Chuck Cox, called his attorney, Ann Bremner, as soon as he found out about Steve's arrest.
He kept telling me that Steve had been arrested, and I kept thinking, he said, Josh. Because he was not on my radar. You know, it was like, oh, Josh, no, Steve.
Both she and Chuck saw it as a major miss by the police.
There was enough circumstantial evidence to say stuff happened right there that night in that place, with or without a body, to say that he got rid of his wife. And I think they could have made that case, but the prosecuting attorney didn't want to do it. But anyway, I do think with him in jail, looking at that, he would have, without being able to talk to his daddy or try and plan some elaborate thing, he would have said, okay, I dumped her here, or I did this, whatever he did, I think we would have known. But they didn't do it.
Not arresting Josh that night would come to have catastrophic consequences. The next day, Friday, September 23rd of 2011, proved to be a very busy one for Josh. He had two court hearings in the morning over his feud with the Coxes and the matter of publishing Susan's journals. A horde of reporters chased him through the hallways.
Number 7 on our docket, Cox versus Powell.
Judge Vicki Hogan presided over the diary case this morning in Pierce County, Washington. Authorities for the Powell family argued for the release of Susan's childhood writings. Her husband Josh's reasoning, according to a filed statement, helping her be understood is the best means of bringing her home.
We do not believe that they had the right to publish her private diaries. We don't believe they prove anything about her state of mind as a 28-year-old woman.
Judge Hogan ruled with the Cox family and said Susan's journals cannot be released. There is no legitimate public interest and they are not a public record.
Judge Hogan even went so far as to say the publication of Susan's journals was highly offensive to a reasonable person. The injunction demanded the removal of the already published journal entries from the SusanPowell.org website. It also prohibited any news stories from going online and blocked Josh and his family from even talking about the contents of Susan's journals. Steve made an initial court appearance that day as well, pleading not guilty to all 15 counts. He and Josh talked through things over the phone as Steve sat in the Pierce County Jail.
There's one phone call, I think, where Josh actually says, yeah, this is a recorded line. You know, which it tells you when you make phone calls and kind of puts them in check, kind of, which was weird.
Josh told Steve to be careful about what he said and to sit tight because the family would get him a good lawyer. After the hearings, Susan's sister Denise spoke through tears, begging Josh and Steve to come clean.
It's hard, and I just want this all to come to a close, and whether she's alive or dead, just let me know where she's at so our family can be over this. I just want him to talk to the police, and I want Josh to talk to the police, and just, if you're so innocent as you claim, why aren't you talking? And I know she didn't run away with somebody. That's just unbelievable that they're even continuing to say that. Those boys were her life.
Chuck Cox told reporters that in spite of Steve's arrest, they were no closer to knowing what had actually happened to Susan.
We still don't know where she is, so we're still concerned about that. But we're also very concerned for the welfare of our grandchildren, and we want what's best for them.
Will you be able to get custody of the grandchildren, or at least take care of them, or are they in the hands of the state?
We're doing everything legally that we can.
Josh still had some fight left in him. That afternoon, he headed to the Washington State Children's Administration office in Tacoma for an FTDM, or Family Team Decision-Making Meeting. It was his chance to explain where he wanted his sons to end up in the immediate future. Tears gathered in the corners of Josh's eyes as he said his boys needed to be protected from the Coxes. Their home was the last place he wanted his sons to live. In paperwork filed along with that meeting, Josh listed his religion as not Mormon. That same afternoon, social worker Rocky Stevenson sat down with Josh for an interview. They chatted about Josh's parenting style and how he disciplined the kids before getting to the matter of Steve's arrest. Josh said he was only somewhat aware of the charges and that he hadn't watched the TV news coverage because he found it depressing. Stevenson told Josh police had found voyeur videos and images showing prepubescent girls in the nude in Steve's bedroom. Josh said he didn't know anything about that and had never seen his dad recording kids. He did admit, though, Steve was obsessed with Susan. Josh said he had erupted at his dad after the search warrant raid in August. Steve had come clean to his son about what he had written in his journals and apologized. Josh didn't let it go. He said they had fought for 2 straight weeks, with Josh telling Steve he might have to move out of his own home in order to protect Charlie and Braden. Josh even told Stevenson about the time in 2003 when Steve had confessed his love to Susan. He explained Susan had been partly responsible. He said she'd invited Steve to feel her freshly shaved legs, after all. But that was all in the past. Josh wasn't going to let what had happened so long ago get in the way of his love for his father. Josh's willingness to forgive his father had long bothered Susan. In an email on March 3rd of 2004, she wrote about the negative emotions she felt following Steve's love confession the prior summer.
What level of forgiveness do I need to attain for my own spiritual health? I avoid any interaction, and any time he is discussed, it is definitely with negative emotion. And I really see no reason for my husband to continue a relationship, let alone any interaction with him.
5 years later, in August of 2009, she wrote another email in which she noted how being around Steve had changed Josh.
Which is crazy, because he's rationalized now that that whole issue was my fault. Back then, he was almost willing to cut his dad out of his life and wasn't expecting me to ever have to interact with him again. But once we moved away and the kids came, that all changed. Now I feel like his dad and brothers are out to sabotage our marriage.
Stevenson authored a report that described Josh as stoic and cautious. It seemed obvious from his answers that he was downplaying Steve's crimes and intended to defend his father. That was a cause for concern. Charlie and Braden remained with the foster family through the weekend. The foster parents were impressed with Charlie's inquisitive mind, calling him gifted. He used words most 6-year-olds wouldn't know, like noticeable and hilarious. Braden often replied to anything Charlie said by saying, "Me too." Charlie's vocabulary wasn't the only thing that surprised the foster family. He talked about hating Jesus and about Mormons trying to steal him. Charlie said his dad had told him Jesus was bad. Braden said the police were bad, too, but not as bad as God. At that, Charlie interjected, telling his younger brother that their foster family attended a good church. They were not Mormon. On Monday, the boys went through physical exams, which showed they were both generally in good health. There were no clear indications that either had been the victims of sexual abuse. Rocky Stevenson, the social worker, attempted to interview both Charlie and Braden, but neither was willing to talk about their family life. That afternoon, the Children's Administration allowed Josh to have supervised visitation with his sons. Afterward, he cornered Stevenson with a pile of news clippings, flyers, and court declarations. He sniffled and became teary-eyed as he described how the Coxes had branded him as a murderer. He told Stevenson that he had never hurt Susan, not intentionally. Josh wanted the state to intervene on his behalf in court, arguing against the Coxes' request for custody of the boys. He didn't get that wish. The next day, Washington placed the boys with Chuck and Judy Cox. When they arrived at the Cox home, the boys ran ahead of the social worker and were greeted at the door by their grandpa, the one who wasn't in jail. To Chuck, it seemed obvious that Josh had already tried to turn the boys against him.
When we first got here, the boys came in and say, are they going to abuse us now? So where'd they get that from? You know, and obviously the social workers knew that, okay, that somebody's told them that, and so they had tried, but we could also say, no, your mother didn't leave you, she loves you, and they knew that.
Braden went into the living room where he saw a picture of Susan. He pointed it out, saying that was his mom, and she was a good mom. In an email sent a little over a year before she died, Susan wrote about her love for the boys.
I try so hard to at least about 10 times a day tell my children, I love you. You are my favorite, Charlie. I'm so lucky to have you. You are a special boy. You are so smart. All of this for a 3-year-old. And now he at random says, Mommy, I love you. Which is probably the only reason I've been able to survive with no affection from my husband for so long.
Legally speaking, the boys were still in protective custody. That status was only temporary and would expire unless the Children's Administration could make a compelling case to keep the kids out of the Powell home. Josh, the Coxes, and the state social workers all met before a judge early on the morning of Tuesday, September 28th. Josh said he wanted the boys back. Failing that, he wanted them back in a foster home, anywhere but with his in-laws. The judge disagreed on both counts, saying Charlie and Braden would stay with the Coxes. Josh said he didn't want his sons attending any religious services, so the court allowed Josh a 3-hour supervised visitation window on Sundays while the Coxes were at church. This would have broken Susan's heart. In a letter to Josh a year before she disappeared, she wrote,
I want my husband back. Want to know that I can talk openly about religion in my own home without worry that my husband, their father, is going to make me feel about 2 inches tall for believing there is a higher being, a bigger purpose. If you don't want to believe anymore, that is your choice. But you don't need to bring others down with you.
On the next episode of Cold.
They said, well, we're going to load that car up and take it back to Utah. And I'm like, what? So I called our police chief and says, so can they just take this car? And says, yeah, you got to give them that car.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Cold. Toss us a rating or a review. You can find Cold on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Cold Podcast. For video clips, pictures from the case, and more, hit up thecoldpodcast.com. Also, if Susan's story sounds familiar in your own life, in other words, if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, please get immediate help. In the U.S., support is a phone call away at the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or online at www.thehotline.org. A quick thank you to the team. Kristen Sorensen, Eric Openshaw, Ken Fall, Danielle Prager, Kira Faramond, Becky Bruce, Josh Tilton, Adam Mason, Jillian Friedman, and especially Cheryl Worsley. The music for Cold was composed by Michael Bonmiller, except for the guitar stuff. That was me. Cold is a KSL podcast. Thank you for listening. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Cold ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at listenerstudy.com.